Donnie, would you mind starting us off in prayer, Charles?
Shall we pray? The Heavenly Father, we come before your presence, thanking you so much for allowing us the opportunity to be gathered again as your people to study another portion of your word. We are thankful for the lessons that will be derived from the text today, and may we in some ways bless us as we live our lives for you. We pray for the teacher this morning. May you give him a ready recollection of the things that he has studied, and we all be blessed through the study. Continue to be with us and bless us, to God, for this supper in Jesus' name. Amen.
Right, Esther 3 through 5, but we need to go back a little bit and pick up the end of chapter 2. Where did we leave Esther off? Not the book of Esther. Where did we leave off with the lady Esther? Chosen to Queens. She's now married to Ahasuerus, living in the palace, and the king has given a great feast for everyone. It's Esther's feast in the end of verse 18. He also grants a remission of taxes and gives gifts, so this is a time to celebrate. So Esther has made it. They all lived happily ever after. So the end of chapter 2, there's another story. What happens here? Right, and so who just happens to be nearby to hear it? Mordecai. And so Mordecai is here sitting at the king's gate, and he hears about Bigthan and Teresh, two of the eunuchs, and they had become angry and wanted to kill King Ahasuerus, and so he lets Queen Esther know. And what happens as a result of Mordecai's discovery? I know these guys are executed, but what else happens? This is really important for the rest of the story. Yeah, it's recorded in the Chronicles, the book of the Chronicles, in the presence of the king. So he says, write this down. So write down that on this date, very important thing in the life of the king is that the king was saved from a terrible plot against him. Okay, and Mordecai is the one who saved him. All right, written down. By the way, this will be important later in verse 23 and chapter 2. It says the men were both hanged on the gallows. What do other translations say?
Yeah,
hanged on a tree. Okay. Other translations?
Suspended on a stake.
They impaled them. Right? So all those pictures of, yeah, that's what's happening. This is going to be interesting later, but this is sort of a prototype for Roman crucifixion. Mm-hmm. Okay? So this is an early take, the Persians' take on crucifixion. The Romans learned some things from them. All right. Now, real quick, because Nathan had asked, and it was a good question that I didn't prepare for. Remember our chart here? Oh, I thought I took the animation off. You've got Esther being crowned queen of Persia in the reign of Xerxes. Ahasuerus, from what I understand, is just the Hebrew version of the name Xerxes. And so you've sort of got a Hebrew, Greek, and then it's transliterated for us as Ahasuerus. I don't know a lot about that language, but this is who you're looking at. So sometimes you think, oh, Ahasuerus, some translations say Artaxerxes, but it's not Artaxerxes as we know it. Historically, it's Xerxes the First, Xerxes the Great. Okay. Now, when we get into chapter 3, 4, and 5, that's what we're covering today. We would take some time to read it, but I really just want to hear from you. We meet a fellow named Haman, or Haman, right? I'll keep saying Haman, that's what I grew up calling him, but heard someone call him Haman, that's probably right, but I'm not Arabic, so try that. So Haman, we meet Haman. Tell me about Haman.
Arrogant.
He's arrogant. You get a big thumbs down from Phil. What else? I asked you in question number one to describe his character. And what I would love you to do is not just tell me adjectives and descriptors, which is great. Arrogant, thumbs down. But tell me lines from a story that indicate, okay, this is the kind of person we're dealing with here. Layla?
He's the kind of person who sets himself up for being glorified. And we can see that specifically when the king asks a very conveniently vague question. He says,
Oh, wait. Are you getting to chapter 6? Don't do it.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's great, though. That's, you're right. That does tell us more about Haman. See, I won't do it. But that's right. Yes, he likes to receive glory. Loves that. Nithin?
He's forgiving.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes. How do you know that? I know chapter 6.
What was back to the fact that Mordecai would not bow or give him what he's looking for,
okay,
so to speak.
Mordecai's not going to bow down.
No. And he's not going to take that stand. So
he's walking along, and here's everybody bowing down. Mordecai standing in the corner, not bowing down. I don't know if he looked like this when he's not bowing down, but like he's not bowing down. And so, what is Haman's response to this?
Mordecai, what's going on? What's wrong? Like, why are we not getting along here? Like, everyone's bowing down. Let's come over and let's have some tea. Let's talk about this. Like, he doesn't do that. What does he do?
He just gets upset within himself.
Well, that's true, but what else does he do?
Not to kill him.
Well, he finds out that Haman is. You gonna help me out here?
Well, part of what you're talking about, I didn't think about this element. I had imagined that Haman was the one who was seeing it day after day and his anger was building, but in reality it was like the officials were seeing it day after day and saying, like, Mordecai, what's going on? And then they finally come to Haman and tell him. And then he's filled with, like, it's this very abrupt, like, it's not a slow building kind of thing for him. So he has a very extreme reaction.
Uh-huh.
And then it says he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone.
Yes.
So, like, he is seeking to do the most damage possible.
So he discovers that Mordecai is a
Jew.
And therefore he should kill all the
Jews.
Huh. Okay. Nathan? Why was Mordecai not? Okay, I didn't ask that question. So, moving on. No, that's a good question. So, let's talk about that. Why is Mordecai not bowing down to Haman?
Was Haman being overly glorified?
So, some have suggested that maybe bowing down to Haman was sort of like a form of worship. Which may be the case. Not sure. Phil, you had a thought? She got it. Okay, Katie? Yeah. Yeah. Now they would not bow down to the image, but it is interesting in Daniel they're not bowing down. It says every time the image is mentioned, it's the image that the king had made. So there's something there about glorifying the king by glorifying the image. That might be part of that. Amy. So there's a possibility too, okay? David?
Just think of it, just thinking of him as an Agagite, his heritage could play something with some parts.
Okay. I think those are the two best explanations. I don't know which one it is. Michelle?
And my vision says, Mordecai bowed not in reverence. So it has that indication that not only were people bowing down, it was sort of kind of almost like worshiping him.
Yeah, and there's some interpretive choice going on there about how to read that. There are other places in Scripture where people bow down to other people, and it's the same wording. So, for example, in Genesis, I made a note about this, Genesis 33 and verse 3. Do you remember Jacob's coming back to see Esau, and what does he do? And he sends all the animals, right? But then he says, he bows down seven times. Or even in 1 Samuel 24. Where, remember Saul, you know, has his moment in the cave, and then David cuts off pieces of his robe, and then David feels really bad about this later, so he comes out and shows himself to Saul, and then it says he bows with his face down to the ground before Saul. So I think this is a typical way to show honor to people. Jacob's trying to show honor to Esau because he had not been honorable toward him before. David's trying to show deference to Saul. So just the wording itself, I appreciate what you're saying about reverence, because that only God should be worshipped, right? So that's spot on. But if it's being interpreted that way by the people, then Mordecai, for a good reason, is not bowing down. David, you have a follow-up?
Either way, if it's for heritage or for idolatry or whatever the case is, it has something to do with the fact that he is a Jew.
Yes.
It seems that. So it's something to do with his own heritage, his own being a Jew. So maybe something to do with his religion. So
either his dedication to God for his heritage. We'll talk about this in a second, Lynn.
Is it part of it that's combined with this idea of homage? So the bowing is associated with the homage that they're paying.
Yeah, and again, homage isn't this, I mean, the question is it worship? Like, are we treating him like God? Homage itself, honor, same kind of idea. Meredith?
This isn't really an answer, but more of a question. I find it curious that he makes such an effort for Esther to keep herself a low profile as being a Jew, but he's not. Stay low profile. You know, like, this is going to be...
Literally
like,
not a low
gonna
profile.
He's going to stand out. Like, it's clearly known that he's a Jew amongst
yes.
the people, so it's interesting.
Yeah. Is it because he's a man or he's older? Maybe he's already started to suffer because he's a Jew and he's trying to protect her from that? I'm not sure. It's a good question. So talk about, I'm just going to say Haman now. Haman's history, it says he's an Agagite. So what does that mean? It's almost a Gentile. He's a Gentile, yeah, for sure. He's a Gentile. John? I saw a little bit of intelligence. There we go, yeah, King Agag, king of the Amalekites, 1 Samuel 15. Now, this is in some way a theory. I don't know that we can prove that that's what an Agagite is, a descendant of Agag, but that's what seems to make a lot of sense. So perhaps Mordecai is saying, I'm not going to bow down to this enemy of Israel. We first meet Agag in 1 Samuel 15 when Saul is supposed to kill all the Amalekites, and he does not. And so King Agag is spared, and so it may be that he has a descendant who passes on down, and there's a new break there. I struggle with that a little bit because it looks like they're all destroyed, but then you do meet some again later. You know, later when Saul himself dies, there's another Amalekite that comes upon him, so perhaps the line does continue. Makes sense. But we actually meet the Amalekites even earlier than that. Where do we first meet the Amalekites? Joshua's leading the people against the Amalekites in Exodus 17. And so there God has it written down, I'm going to strike them out, like I'm going to remove them from the face of the earth because they've been an enemy to my people. So perhaps Mordecai is saying, I know who this man is. I know he's an enemy of God's people. I know that it's been foretold, it's been commanded they should be struck down. I'm not going to bow down. Either way, like David said, it does come back to the idea that Mordecai is a Jew. And so now, as we said, talking about, this is a long way around to answer the question, Haman's character. He's an arrogant blowhard because, and he's so full of himself that he's willing to destroy an entire race of people because somebody won't show him honor. Ooh, okay, you see what pride does. See what arrogance does. Okay, thoughts about that, David?
I'm just thinking that this is the same character that we saw in Esther 1. Here is Ahasuerus worried about the image that he is losing.
Yes.
Haman comes along. He's this, of the same character. He's worried about, wait, here's one that's mm-hmm. not bowing down to my wishes. And so he's worried about what that's going to produce. And so all of these people who are so focused on power and focused on themselves are worried about what they're about to lose.
Yes. Yeah, so I want my wife to respect me, I want this man to respect me, and so we're going to make laws that just demand respect. You know the best way to get respect is? You know, what's the best way? To be respectable. And to live an honorable life. To demand respect? Not going to work so well. But to be an honorable person? Yeah. Nathan? If he's not a what? Oh, yes. Yeah, so you're suggesting maybe a third option is that Mordecai says, I'm not bowing down to him because I'm not bowing down to anybody. And so maybe he's the kind of person who just doesn't show that kind of deference.
Yeah, if it is like what we discussed, we were discussing, is it because of idolatry or mostly because he's a Jew and he should not do it because he's a Gentile or any other thing?
Yeah.
Coming out of pride or jealousy, if Mordecai wouldn't have kept that in his heart and been humble about it, then this escalation will happen.
Yeah, so if if it were just an issue of pride in Mordecai's heart, if he'd been humble, then yeah, escalation would have happened. Of course, Mordecai can't be to blame for genocide.
Right.
That's on Haman.
Yeah.
But I think Mordecai is generally exonerated, vindicated in the book. So I don't take this as an issue of pride for him. But I understand maybe that's a thought there.
I have a question prior to when we started. Fast forward in order. Is there ever a time you misinterpret honor? Because Romans 13:7 does say, give honor to the one of you.
Yes.
But sometimes I think as Christians we perceive giving another man honor, a judge or whoever, in the way that we behave or react is not God. Because we are in some ways sinning because we are somehow giving what should be to God to that individual. So the question remains, where is the line drawn?
That's a good question. I think I appreciate that part. So that's a good question. Give you two examples here. I was talking with many of us know Edward, right? Edward Chen.
Yeah.
Went back to China. Before he left, we were having conversations about family. One of the things that they often do in China, culturally, is they eat a meal in honor of their dead loved ones. All right? So are we just honoring their memory, or is this worship? And we had a discussion, but he brought this up. I said, by the way, your culture, he's bringing this up, what do I do about this? And he concluded this is something that I can't participate in because it goes too far. And we're basically treating them like deified people. So there's an example. I don't have that in my culture. What I do have in my culture, though, don't get me wrong, I don't know if I can say it's a sin to put a poster of a sports star on your bedroom wall. It'd be weird if I did that. I'm married. Lindsay wouldn't like that. But you know, okay, or like a pop star or, you know, famous movie star or something like that, that's on your wall. And then you see these people who go to the concerts and are just screaming and fainting in the stands. Isn't that worship? I mean, convince me that that's not worship. Again, not saying the poster thing is, but at some point there's a line there that we may have crossed where this is the kind of person that I know everything about them. I know where they grew up, where they're born. I know the names of their kids. I know like how many times they've been married. And like I start idolizing this person. Okay, I'm not bowing down to them, but am I kind of ordering my life around them and developing a passion and devotion for them? I'm having a hard time not seeing that as some form of worship. Other thoughts, ideas about that? Okay. I'm seeing people thinking. But we can come back to that later if you like. Now, Haman decides that he is going to not lay hands on Mordecai alone. And so he's going to seek to destroy all the Jews in verse 6. Oh, by the way, other things about his character before we move on. Evelyn? Yeah, and another thing about Haman, in a similar way, he's fragile, the king's fragile, we see a lot of fragile leadership. But something about Haman is he seems to be a very intelligent person. I don't know that Ahasuerus is not an intelligent person, but he depends so much on the wisdom of other people. Haman is someone that you wouldn't think is so fragile. You wouldn't think is so weak. He's proud, he seeks honor, he's intelligent, he's got the king's ear, he's going to get the king's signet ring. I mean, he looks like someone who's just really, really powerful. But pride is actually a demonstration of weakness. We're overinflated. And, you know, like when you blow up a balloon too much, you're kind of watching, waiting for it to boom. Like that's us in pride. So very intelligent, looks very strong, but pride makes him weak. Haman is going to come to the king, and he describes this people group in verse 8. Certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. The king takes the signet ring, gives it to Haman the Agagite, son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. All right, so let's talk a little bit about his description of the Jews here. Yays and nays. Inge says, pretty spot on, okay? What do you think, Inge?
It's very similar to the way God describes his people, even in the book of Deuteronomy, they're a special people.
Okay.
And they're going to be different than all the other nations, and they're going to be scattered and dispersed, and they're going to have different laws from everybody else.
Okay. So they are different, they are distinct. You can go back and read, we're reading Leviticus as a family right now, and talking about all the distinctions God is making with them, separation of the holy and the profane. And in some way, if you read king's laws as king's customs, like they're not going to be participating in a lot of the things the Persians do. I can see that. Amy?
It reminds me of times where either Satan lies, or like when Jesus is accused, there is some truth in it.
Yes.
But his point is, it's not to the benefit of the king. Whereas when God sent them to captivity, he told them, seek the benefit of this city.
Yes.
The fact that they're different and that they're following God is not something terrible for the king. And
right.
So it seems to me like you know, he's going to destroy this temple. Jesus did say that, but it seems like it could be taken out of context.
Right. Very similar to what they say of Stephen, right? Yeah, I think this is pushed too far. Were the Jews going to hurt them? No. In fact, God had told Jeremiah, like, you tell the people, seek the benefit of the city. Wherever you're going to go, like plant trees, plant orchards, get married, have families, like live in captivity. And I know we talked about, is this captivity? They're still in captivity, okay? The return of captivity has already happened, but they're still living in a place that's not their home. And so you be good citizens. What do they think of Christians in the first century? Second century? Were Christians good citizens?
So that's different.
Depends on what you mean by that. Did they support the economy? You read the book of Acts, and what did Demetrius the silversmith think about that? Did the Christians support the economy?
No.
What did the economy revolve around? Idolatry. These guys are bringing a ruin on Ephesus, okay? We know that Artemis and she's the goddess and all the, and they're turning this world upside down. And so in some ways, Christians are not good for society. If you want society to continue down the path of idolatry and morality, but are they good for society in that they promote righteousness and justice and fairness? Absolutely. So this is gonna rub people the wrong way. So you can see Haman making this case here. Other thoughts about the pros and cons of his mistake?
That wasn't similar to in Nehemiah's time, the accusation that was brought by
yes.
What's his name again?
Tobiah.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was that?
Sandal.
Yes, very similar. I think that was what Amy was suggesting too. Is really, really what you suggested was similar to the accusation. Just say yes. Yes, very similar to that. So Jews are going to be, God's people will be facing this anywhere. I think we should expect the same kind of thing to be misrepresented. I think it's just one of the worst feelings to be misrepresented, to be misunderstood. I've found that to be one of the greatest pains. People think evil of you when you mean good. We don't mind it too bad when people think good of us. But people just misunderstand completely. They don't get you, and they start accusing you and believing false things about you. It's just terrible. But that's something that God's people have always faced. So that's something to get used to. Now, let's talk a little bit about Ahasuerus and his leadership style, from chapter 3. And I asked you this question to consider Matthew 20, 20 through 28, but that's just sort of an example because I didn't want to give you a vague question, just a specific example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. But first, just talk about him and his leadership in this section.
It just takes it from face value what he says. Like, I mean, at least it's not documented, but there's no questions asked. There's no, like, wait, what people are you talking about? It's just like, here you go.
No.
Come on.
In fact, what has Haman done to kind of sweeten the deal? I'll pay for this myself. This won't come out of the king's treasury. I'll take care of the cost of it. And it seems like, if I'm reading correctly, Ahasuerus says, no, 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 you don't have to eat that. I'll take care. So he offers to pay the 10,000 talents, and he says, no, 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 you got the ring, you got the authority, you just take it, whatever. But what's he doing while he's having this conversation? What are they doing? More drinking. We're going to see that alcohol is a favorite friend of his. He doesn't have to face reality, doesn't have to face responsibilities. Other observations about his character here. Man, you have something?
Thinking about my kids came to me and they're like, hey mom, we have this really great idea and we want to make sure that we do X, you know. I would go, well, what exactly are you asking? And here we have Haman coming to Ahasuerus and being like, wow, it doesn't benefit the king. So you want to make sure that they don't bother you. Like, it's this vague, general, whatever. I don't think Ahasuerus knows he wants to kill every single one of them. It's just this general, it needs to be taken care of. And Ahasuerus doesn't ask any questions or dig into, like, what exactly do you mean? How do you plan to do that? He just gives him free rein.
I'm sure he knows they're going to be destroyed. I mean, he says,
say verse 9,
that they'd be destroyed. And then but you're right, he doesn't want to know the details.
Yeah.
Just do what seems good to you. You know, and how flippant he is with the lives of how many people? You don't even know how many people? And just, yeah, take them out, not a big deal. When the job of the king is to protect the people. And he's saying, except for those people. Meredith, you have a thought?
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of the same thing, like even going back to, like, he's the party guy. He wants to keep his people happy. And if one of his, like, people that he's given authority to comes to him with a suggestion, he's like, yeah, sure, sounds good. You know, he just takes it.
Yes. Now, let me back off that a little bit. I think you're exactly right. I said they were drinking when they had this conversation. I don't think we see drink until the very end, but that's just kind of typifying his leadership style. But you're right. He wants to be the fun leader.
Yeah,
so if anything gets in the way of them having fun, let's just push that down and deal with the fun. April?
I was just thinking about how he does have to come to him.
Yes.
But he doesn't, he's very passive in the responsibility that's supposed to come with his authority. Like, if he's disrespected by Vashti, no, I want to bring your wife. Or somebody comes to me, they say, oh, this will, you know, the way it's portrayed, he's not looking into, does this benefit the people I'm leading? He's just using his authority very passively.
So consider the example of Diotrephes in 3 John. There's this church, and Gaius is writing to John. John's responding, and there's been word about Diotrephes in 3 John 9. Diotrephes likes to put himself first, does not acknowledge our authority. It looks like nobody's really willing to stand up to Diotrephes, and John says, when I get there, I'll deal with it myself. And I've known of churches. I worked with an eldership once. There was someone who was teaching and wanted to teach, and they said, well, yeah, we'll let him teach, and he just kind of took over. And they said, well, what do we do? He wants to teach. You've got to take responsibility. I knew of another church that said, no, you're not, and promptly they left. But, you know, you've got to spot that. You've got to take responsibility, and the buck stops here, is right. Someone's got to be in charge. Being in charge doesn't mean that everybody honors you. Being in charge means that, well, I did give you the example of Matthew 20, 23, 28. What does Jesus say about real leadership? Yes, a servant of all. The sign of the greatest in the kingdom is whoever has the most people in front of him. It's measured by how many people you have in front of yourself. And so Jesus is the greatest because he became the least. So, so different than Haman.
I was just thinking of your question of, like, contrasting
sanctuary, it's like he's promoting those who are going to give him things.
Yeah.
And we have the leadership of Christ where he is pouring himself out to the point of death, even to those who are hating him and are eventually going to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. Other thoughts, David?
The same theme of just being afraid of what he's going to lose comes back, and just contrasting that with what Jesus, he's willing to lose everything for us. Also, just a king that is does not know where his kingdom is. Contrast that with Jesus in Revelation 2 and 3. I know, I know, I know.
Yes.
The king who is, okay, you take care of it, versus Jesus who is the king on the white horse coming to save his people.
Yeah.
And
of course, Jesus does delegate, right? He sends out the disciples and delegates that, but you see he knows what's going on. So, excellent example there. And of course, in the occasion of Matthew 20, when James and John come and the mother comes, they want to ask, Jesus doesn't say, oh, yes, I have to have my kingdom. It's, what do you want? Like, he's investigating, he's researching, he's trying to understand what's going on. Know well the condition of your flocks. All right, other thoughts here, Michelle?
Yes, so the same passage you gave us as a contrast, that scenario when the James and John, their mother came to Jesus, still used authority over the situation. Like he didn't like just go along like Paul Ahasuerus went along and let them know it is not mine to give. But in the same way, we see that comment you made about the Lord of the Gentiles, how they lorded over their people. That's how I see Haman, because he was lording his authority and wanting everybody to bow down.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, Haman makes his plan, and it says that he summons together the scribes on the 13th day of the first month, and there's this edict, and they cast lots to determine the timing. But look at verse 13. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. And so they send copies and couriers out everywhere. And while they're going out everywhere, the king and Haman are sitting down to drink, and the city of Susa is thrown into confusion.
Can I ask you a question in reference to the time frame?
Okay.
Of when the edict went out and when the actual killing would have occurred?
Mm-hmm. What's the question?
Like, what's the time frame? Like, how much time?
Oh, how much time?
When the edict went out and when they would.
Well, you get the. They're summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and then it says the 13th day of the 12th month. So they're going to have about a year, 11 months to...
I don't understand Jewish calendar.
Yeah, they've got 12 months in their calendar as well.
Oh.
Which, again, if I'm Haman, be like, tomorrow, let's do this tomorrow. But they decided to cast lots and get the approval of the gods, I think, is what they're after. Okay? So, leadership style here, one of the, Katie?
What's interesting kind of with the timing, I didn't notice this before, but it almost seems like he chose the day, like the cast lots before he had even talked to the king about it, which just shows, I guess Haman is pretty confident that the king's going to let him do it.
In some ways, he's kind of like Nehemiah, right? Before he goes to the king, he's got his plan all together, and then he springs it. So, while there are good people who are planning, there are also evil people. Think about what's happening where they are just drinking buddies, just, you know, patting each other on the back, and meanwhile the kingdom is just in uproar, totally confused, coming apart, and everyone is terrified. And even if you're not a Jew, you might be looking at your Jewish neighbors, you're thinking, we're friends. And what's going to happen to you? And what are we going to do for you? And not everyone's like that. Some are thinking, oh no, I can't wait to take them. Can't wait to get rid of them. And so the whole kingdom is just falling apart, and again, these two leaders are just taking care of themselves. We do have to say that's bad leadership. Right? Then you look at Jesus and the way that he rules his kingdom, and there's peace, and there's righteousness, and there's wisdom, and there's justice, and you're just totally different. Lynn.
That comparison or contrast stood out to me of know well the state of your flocks. Like, Jesus knows the state of your flocks. He knows his people. He's in amongst them. He is seeking them. And then here we have just a perfect example of you're living in your own world. You're ignoring the facts of what's around you. You are not connected to your kingdom or the reality of the situation. You're just in your own little bubble of whatever you want your world to be.
Right.
And it's not accurate.
Now, back in chapter 2, look at verse 16. It's the seventh year of the king's reign. And here we are in chapter 3, verse 7. It's the 12th year of the reign. So Esther has been married to the king for about 5 years now. Okay? 4 or 5 years. We've not seen her at all in this chapter. We don't know what's been going on, but she apparently is living well. But Mordecai sees what's going on. The Jews in the city see what's going on. He goes into mourning, sackcloth, ashes. He's crying out with a loud and bitter cry. And word gets back to Esther about what's going on with Mordecai and how he is there fasting and weeping and lamenting in sackcloth and ashes. So, what does she do? There. We'll make it better. We'll put some clothes on. Let's talk a little bit about her development. Earlier, she just does whatever Mordecai says. Now she's in a position of power. And she sees that Mordecai is upset, and so she sends clothes. I don't know that she's just saying, let's just cover up the sorrow, but there aren't questions. And so Mordecai has to send back, well, here's what's going on. Don't you know the trouble that we're in? And so, verse 6, Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened in the exact sum of money, a payment of promise, gives a copy of the written decree, shows it to Esther. And so you've got this back and forth. So talk a little bit about the development of Esther's character here. What do you see in her? What does she do from here on out? If you've got your study guide, this would be question 4. Then?
Well, kind of the progression that I had her moving through is she kind of starts in ignorance. And I don't know if that's necessarily all her fault because she's living in a palace in a secluded situation as a wife. But she starts with ignorance, and her first response then when she does hear about what's going on is kind of fear. Like there's, she knows what could happen to her life. But then we see her grow from that into acceptance of what she needs to do, and then she makes preparation for what she needs to do. So that's what I saw by the end of chapter 4.
Okay. So she determines that she is, maybe you have a thought. She determines that she's going to do something about this, but at first, Haman says, you've got an opportunity. He commands, so verse 10. Esther spoke to Hathach, commanding him to go to Mordecai and say, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there's but one law to be put to death, except the one whom the king holds out the golden scepter. So Mordecai is saying, look, you're in a position. You can do something about this. And Esther says, if I do and it goes badly, I'm dead. Okay. Michelle? She's just following the plan, right?
Yes.
It's been 5 years. She's just keeping up with Mordecai had told her.
Right. And now that he's telling her, well, if you don't go, deliverance will come from somewhere else and you and your family will be destroyed. I still see it as in that same vein. She's asking for courage by asking him to fast and pray for her. But I still see it in that same vein as she being obedient and loyal because he's part of her family. So if he's telling her that she and her family will be destroyed, that includes him too.
Yeah, God's going to use this, obviously. I mean, Mordecai, the decision to hide the fact that she's a Jew I doubt the wisdom of that decision. But it's gotten her in this position, and now God's going to use that. And so I think you're right. She's being loyal to Mordecai. She's showing honor to him, trying to bring up clothes. But now she's in a spot. And Mordecai's in a spot, because if she continues to follow his previous advice, they're all dead. April?
She's also someone in authority, but she's also in submission. And I think she ends up doing a really good job of using the authority she has for the good of others,
right,
which is in contrast to Ahasuerus.
Yes,
and Haman. And so she uses it, like things like calling a feast and making decisions and realizing, like, when she gets to the point, like, if I perish, I perish. And she has to go through the process of getting to. But then we see the way she goes about it. She's very aware of the way she also uses these incidents, I think. However she started out, she's, I feel like, growing in this to both use authority and submission, not focused on herself.
Yeah, she realizes she's the one in the position, not Mordecai, not anybody else. And so if someone's going to make a plan to help the Jewish people, it's got to be her. And that's kind of what Mordecai tells her. Relief is going to come from somewhere. Who knows whether you've not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. But think about the choice that she's facing. If this goes badly, she could die. But if she does what she's supposed to do and honors God and loves the people, then they can be saved. Okay, so how do you weigh this out? I think on paper, there's no doubt what the right thing to do is. It's just the right thing. Sometimes it's not hard to figure out what the right thing to do is. It's just hard to think about the cost. I know what the right thing to do is. But if I'm in this position, this could hurt. This could really backfire. At the same time, if it does and she dies, how is that any worse? So on paper, it all makes sense. Like you go through it. You go and you talk to the king. You can't keep silent. But still, just such courage in her words, verse 16, if I perish, I perish. And so she's the one who comes up with the plan. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to fast for the 3 days. And I think in connection with that, we're going to pray. And so she's getting these things together. And so she's going to go before the king. All right, thoughts or questions through chapter 4. I thought I saw a hand here. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I think, again, it's helpful not to try to make anybody out to be the hero all the way through. I mean, we see some heroic things about Mordecai. We're going to see some heroic things about Esther. We're going to see some good things in the king, even, by the time this is all done. But when we take them off of that pedestal to see them as real, I don't always do things consistent. You know, sometimes Elijah, who's learning to drive, says, Dad, I got a question to you about the way you drove yesterday. Okay? And we have this conversation because I don't always do everything that I know to be true and right. And so I think Mordecai here is recognizing I made a mistake back here. I think this is an admission of that was a fault. But now he's got to come out of that. I don't see it as a moral deficiency necessarily, but this was a bad choice. So I don't think I see pride in him so much as protectiveness, but now he's realizing that his desire to protect his niece, or cousin, if you will, should not have gone above his loyalty to God. He should have trusted God on that one, and he doesn't. And you see the same thing with Abraham, you see with Isaac, and they lie about, that's my sister. No, it's not. That's just your wife, dude. But they think about protection, protecting their own lives, protecting their family, instead of just trusting God. That's kind of where I land with that. You want to respond? Well, with the we can at least see with the fasting and the tearing of his clothes that he's trying to appeal to God for salvation. I think we see that at least. But again, I think it's the danger for us to try to make any one character out to be like, this is the whole example. I think we agree with that. So there are going to be faults in work. Lynn?
Could we not say that the beginning of chapter 4, we see a reversal for Mordecai? Because here we have him quietly, privately living as a Jew. That's not something that's known. He's at the king's gate in that state. He's still trying to live according to his conscience, but they still know. But here we have him public, like it says, there was great mourning among the Jews. And so for him to go to the king's gate in this mourning, he is fully aligning himself. I'm a Jew and I am mourning because this applies to me. Is there some of that?
I don't think so. I think Mordecai and what's her name?
Hadassah.
I think they're known to be Jews in the neighborhood. When she gets taken to the palace, don't tell them you're a Jew. I think everybody knows in the neighborhood Mordecai's a Jew. And so like they tell Haman, hey, he's not bowing down. Well, who is he? He's a Jew. Like everybody knows Mordecai's a Jew. So I don't think we're seeing that. But to your point, we are seeing a shift where Esther's taking the lead because she's the one who can serve. And that's what leadership is. Leadership is service. So she takes the lead and she's going to fast here. We got to get through chapter 5 real quickly here. I don't want to rush this, but she makes a plan. She's going to throw a banquet. And she's going to invite Haman and the king. Now, so she goes in, she's wearing the royal robes, and what does the king do?
He loves you.
Yeah, there she is. What is it, Queen Esther? And he approaches, she touches the tip of the scepter. This is such a happy thing. What's your request? So everything's turning out fine. And so bring Haman and come to the banquet that's been prepared, and they come, and they drink, and they feast, and everything's great. And so the king says, now I know that you didn't do all this just to have a feast. What is it you want? Up to... All right, okay, so here we are. And so she says, I'll take half the kingdom. No, verse 7, my wish and request is I've got another banquet for you to come to at another time. Okay, I've found favor in the sight of the king. If so, then grant my wish, fulfill my request. Tomorrow, we'll have a second. Okay, why two meals here?
Well, it reminds me of two saints. Wait till man's had his good stomach. And then, you know, the I can't put it together now, but the one that said about honey and vinegar.
Yes, okay. I think there's a word for this. Esther's using, what was that?
Tact.
Diplomacy, right? And she has some months to work through this, right? So to rush into things, she's trying to be sure that she actually has the favor of the king. It seemed like there was some doubt about that. Maybe some reasons why, we don't know historically, but she can't just waltz into his throne room. Something's off. So before she goes and requests favor for the people, she's got to make sure she has favor from the king herself. Okay, now, the question was, what real world applications can you make of this sort of thing today? Meredith? I thought I saw a hand going.
Oh, no. But, in this case, she needs something and, needs to, change his mind, essentially. She's kind of, building her case and, not rushing it. She's really thinking through, and how do I handle this?
I think sometimes we wait too long to have needed conversations, Other times we just rush to kind of spontaneously knee-jerk do something. Pause, think, reflect, pray. She took time to fast and pray. She's getting advice from other people. And then she acts decisively. And she's got a plan she's going to follow through. That's just such a wise way to go about it. Jordan?
I'm sort of wondering, though, like, how far do we take certain actions before things start shifting from tact into manipulation? Because I might have missed it, but I don't think we get any, like, confirmation that God told her to do this
no.
or that, anything like that. So she seems to be acting on her own. So even though this is, like, something that's, you know, very patient and logical, you know, how far do we sort of take these types of things before it becomes, like, manipulation?
Yeah, she's using discernment, right? So that we don't have a divine word from God about this sort of thing. You see, I think, something similar in the Gospels where Jesus is talking about Matthew 5, you know, leaving your gift at the altar, coming to terms quickly, he says in verse 25, with your accuser while you're going with him to court. And so you're trying to get as little of a loss here as possible. So I think, yeah, I don't want to manipulate and deceive for selfish reasons, but here she's not deceiving. He knows that there's something she wants, and she's trying to communicate. So if I'm not letting someone see the picture, then I think we're shifting into manipulation.
Is this also an interesting portrait of the delicacy of trying to work with someone who does not have the foundation of a belief in God? So it's not like, I know we can learn the lessons of like being patient and being careful in our personal, but like this is a dynamic where she is a Jew following the commandments of her God, and she is dealing with a pagan king who does not have a moral code that matches, so she can't come to him and appeal to him on the basis of God says this is what's right and good. Like, she's having to deal with a worldly man.
Mm-hmm.
So does that play into the delicacy that she is approaching?
No, that's a good point. If you had a Christian boss and you had an unbelieving boss, and I realize they're at the door, I can make this point. And you had to go and address them about something that was really kind of tricky, and you just abruptly go to your Christian boss, you'd hope that because they're a godly person, they're going to be able to take that, right? An unbelieving boss, you catch them at a bad day, I mean, it might be off with your head, right? You just lost your job because you chose the wrong timing. One's guided by good principles, the other's not. And so maybe if you reverse that, here I am, I'm a Christian husband and father. It should be that if my children spring something on me, my wife springs something on me, my brothers and sisters spring something on me, and maybe it's accusatory, maybe it's criticism, maybe it's just a problem, I've had a bad day, and this is not a good time. Hopefully, if I'm guided by godly principles, what am I going to do? I'm going to respond in a godly way. But she's dealing with someone who's not driven by those principles, so she's being careful, I think is a good way to look at that. McCollin?
Yeah, I mean, just going off of that, I think, you know, Jesus tells us to be wise as serpents. And I think just for those reasons, it's because, you know, when we're dealing with the world, there are just certain ways to communicate that are just going to be more effective than others. And so
yes.
Just trying to be able to do things in a way that they can really just get through to people, even if it's not exact, if it looks a little bit funny. But really what's the important thing is like really the heart and the motive behind it. You know, while we're trying to be wise as serpents, this is ultimately for God's glory, not for us to, like, you know, be like this, be even better than the serpent,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, we want to be genuine. And I'll tell you, I think sometimes I soft pedal too much at times. And Lindsay says, you just got to say it. I don't like hurting people, but you got to say it. But we can still use tact. So the honey, as Michelle mentioned. I'm going to say a prayer and close, and then there are people with hands up. I would love to hear from you afterward. Our Father in heaven, thank you for your word. Thank you for this time studying your word together. Appreciative so much of brothers and sisters who take your word seriously and can help me to think through it. Father, thank you for sending your son who said himself, if I perish, I perish, knowing that it wasn't an if, but a when, that his hour would come, and he left his throne to serve a people who were doomed to die. So thank you for his humility, for his sacrifice, and please teach us to follow in his footsteps, to learn to sacrifice our own comforts for the sake of serving your people. It's in the name of Jesus we pray. Amen.